Accession number 30389, Reel 1.
Reel 1, if we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born on the 16th of April 1919 in Grimsby, Lincolnshire. That's the first bit, isn't it? My father, is this how you want me to go? My father was a marine engineer during the First World War in the Merchant Navy. My mother was a nurse, and they were married in 1918 at the end of the war, and I was born 11 months later, 1919. And then after the war, which was then, my father became unemployed, like a lot of people after the war, and was unemployed for 2.5 years. And my mother, having been a nurse and nursed in very nice houses in Grimsby, you know, looked after people who could afford nurses, suddenly found herself waiting on tables at Masonic functions and the like to earn some money, because there was a pittance. We had a very tiny two-roomed house with nothing in the way of furniture that I can remember. We had boxes covered with a piece of cotton material, and one piece of furniture that I remember was an old horsehair sofa. I don't know if you know what they are, but they were dreadful. And visions of my father asleep on there most of the day in front of a range. And my mother used to go some evenings, as I say, and wait on table at these things, these functions. And I used to feel ever so sorry for her, because having been a nurse in a respected profession in those days, and to come to this. My sister was born 13 months after me, and we shared a single bed together, I can remember that. And we always knew when she'd been to one of these functions the night before, because there used to be balloons and carnival novelties and things like that all at the end of the bed, and so we thought Mum's been out again. It must have been, I think, ever so demeaning for her. It wasn't so much for us, because we didn't understand it all. But eventually, my father found work with the Grimsby Ice Company on the fish docks in Grimsby, and they used to manufacture ice for the trawlers to go to sea. And my father was instrumental in designing a chute that took the ice from the factory, you know, sort of overhead and down into the trawlers. And they were away for 2 or 3 weeks, these trawlers, because there was no refrigeration ships or anything like that. So he was instrumental, as I say, in designing that and getting it built. I think my mother just odd jobbed, you know, during this time. And when I was 4, I went to the local primary school, which was called St. Edward's Primary School, Edward Street Primary School. And then I don't know how, in what sequence to tell you these things, really. That's the problem. But we lived in a very small terrace house. And further up the road were some bigger houses, and an old lady lived there with her bachelor son in one of these houses. And she became ill, and my mother used to go in and do for her. I suppose she did housework and what have you, but she also nursed her, like blanket bathed her and kept her comfortable and all this sort of thing. And these are only vague memories. Mrs. Hartley, this lady's name was, and after some period of time that my mother had been looking after her, she died. But before she died, she made a will leaving everything to my mother, with a condition that she looked after her son for the rest of his life. That's the bare bones of it. And Mrs. Hartley died, and so my mother, shortly after that, we all seemed to move into Mrs. Hartley's house, which was a much bigger house with more bedrooms and a middle room that they called in, but an outside loo, of course, as always. And we all moved in there with this Tom, who was about the same age as my father, I think, and a really odd character. Gentle as a lamb, and he looked after his mother and sort of thing. And so we lived in this house for quite a long time, she looking after our Tom. But there was a considerable amount of money, I think. I don't know what I mean by considerable, but My father and Tom bought a car, one of these, I think it was a Humber, an open touring car, a huge thing. And we used to go off for picnics in this car my father used to drive. And we seemed to be ever so affluent. And my father and this Tom used to drink. So they, you know, that started the drinking business. And my mother used to get really browned off. And after she'd had, and I can't remember times, but she did eventually get fed up with the whole thing. So she paid, oh, she sold one of the properties she'd been left, which was a grocery store. That was one of the things. And she sold that and put the money down as a mortgage deposit. And we bought a house on the outskirts of Grimsby, or she did. Very nice house. And we all moved in there. And then I think Tom began to get her down because he was rather simple. And that's not an excuse, it's just that he and my father used to go off drinking and what have you. So with some more of the money, we didn't question at the time that we were suddenly well off. We didn't realize because it was part of growing up and these things were happening. But she bought some caravans and had them sited at Mablethorpe. And I remember the names of those. There was Legsby. What were the other two? Kildare and Killarney. Those were the three names of the caravans. And after what I suppose was a reasonable time, she ensconced Tom into one of these caravans. And she used to rent the other two, like as holiday lets. I loathed them because we used to have to go at weekends to clean these two out, you know, to for the newcomers coming in. We used to cycle miles to these places. And Tom lived there quite happily and got himself, well, got himself a whelk stall, if you know what that is. And he used to sell this shellfish from the side of the road out of a pub, outside a pub. And we used to go down there for holidays and see old Tom. And I mean, we loved him really. He was a dear chap, but anyway, he was out of my mother's hair, and we used to go down and see him. And I don't know if you know Mablethorpe or of Mablethorpe. It's a seaside town on the east coast. And there was a fair on the beach. It was actually on the beach. You used to go down a slipway, and there was the beach. And there were all these amusements. And the things that you did in those days. And one of the things was a booth on the, actually on the beach, for a roll a penny. And you got your pennies and you rolled them down a chute, and whatever number they landed on, you got those coins. And my sister and I used to go there every morning. And we used to get up really early, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and go down there. And we used to bury ourselves underneath so that we could get inside this area and dig in the sand for pennies that had been dropped. And we had enough pennies to keep us going all day on the roll thing. And there was also a music booth where they used to have a musician, I think it was a pianist, and they used to sing all the songs of the day, and the booth used to be packed with everybody singing their heads off. And Audrey and I used to go there. And one of the songs that was ever so popular at the time was Carolina Moon. And so we used to sing our heads off at this, and one day my dad came down and this was being sung and we were enjoying it. And there was a little brooch about so big with of a moon with a lady sitting on it. And he bought us one of those and we were so thrilled. We wore these with such pride, you know, these little brooches. So we had a lot of holidays like that down in Mablethorpe and it was lovely. I don't remember my mother ever working. I'm sure she didn't after this period, you know, because she was obviously a much better off than she'd ever been. And so we seemed to have quite a happy life around that time.
Did the money from the will go solely to her?
Yes, with this provision I told you to look after Tom. And because we were only at that time about 5 or 6 years old, we had no idea of the value of money or what it involved. The impression that it had on me was that, my goodness, we've got a car, and my goodness, Tom buys us a comic every week and sweets and things like that. That's what I meant when I said affluent. It didn't, the word didn't mean anything to me at all, but there was quite a lot of money about. But then I think, I suppose, life jogged on along until, oh, my father had been, I told you, in the Merchant Navy, and he came from Southampton. And all his forebears had been in the Navy, merchant Navy or seaman of some kind. And he used to have a mandolin. And one of the vivid memories of my dad was that he would sit in an armchair with this mandolin. And we'd have all the kids from around about, three or four kids and ourselves. And he used to play this mandolin and sing, and it was absolutely wonderful. And one of the things he used to sing was, I'm a wee Southampton lad, and of Wake I'm not afraid. I can't remember anymore, but we used to sing away, and he was wonderful. And then he used to come home to lunch, and we used to have a magazine every day. I can't remember what it was now. But there was a quiz in it, and I used to sit beside my dad at the table and ask him the quiz questions, and I used to think he was brilliant because he knew every answer. You know, it's such a silly thing, isn't it, to remember, but we did that. And then when the war began, there were rumours of war, he used to do... There used to be a firm in Dartford, J&E Hall, I think it was called, who were refrigerating engineers and specialists. And they used to come down to the ice factory on the docks and do repair work or maintenance or something. And they used to ask my father if he ever wanted to change his job. They would be very pleased to have him. I used to hear these stories, but he never went. And then when the war began, the ice factory was closed down because they weren't icing the trawlers for sea. And Grimsby obviously became a dead town. And then my father went to work for Halls of Dartford, and I think he was known as an outside consultant engineer. He used to travel the country and inspecting refrigerating plants and things like that. And so he used to come home every 6 weeks, and so that was a bleak time. This was sort of at the beginning of the war. But he was just a wonderful man, and he introduced me to Omar Khayyam, which I still love, know nearly every word of it, and Kipling. He introduced me to Kipling, so I used to think he was such a clever man. And he was down in Penzance one Easter inspecting a plant of some kind, and he got the flu, I suppose, took himself to a hospital, and then collapsed and died, 52 years old. And this was devastating for me because I absolutely adored him, and because he'd introduced me to so many things, and I really did adore him. This was, well, the 1940s, and I have to remember things. Don't you really think you want to know about my dad, do you? This is something else that's a bit odd. And I went to Edward Street School, then I went to Harold Street School, and then I took the scholarship exam, the 11 plus exam. And I had a very great friend at that time, Mary Harris. We lived close by, and we used to walk to school together and come back. And we used to be given 2 pence, twopence a day for bus fares, a halfpenny there, a halfpenny back at lunchtime. And Mary and I always used to walk home in the afternoon and save a halfpenny so we could go to the shop and buy whatever was available for a halfpenny. And then walking home, which was just over a mile, we would weave stories about our favourite film stars. Hers was Ronald Coleman, and mine was John Bowles, and we used to weave these romantic stories, I remember, coming home. And then Mary and I took this scholarship exam, and we were both borderline when the results came through. We didn't get a direct entry, and so we were sort of borderline, and I can't remember what the system was, obviously, but by paying some of the fees we were allowed to go because we were borderline. Well, Mary was an only one and her father was a bank manager, so there was no problem. But when it came to me, they couldn't afford to let me go on a fee paying basis, so that I think had been a chip on my shoulder without realising it, that Mary went and I didn't. And so I went on to the other school, to Westborough School, and didn't shine at anything, I don't think. And so left when I was 14 and went to work. I left for school on Friday, and on Monday morning I started working in a dress shop. And we worked from 9 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night for 5 shillings a week, selling dresses. I was quite happy, I just liked the clothes and things like that. Not a very rewarding job though. And I got 5 shillings a week, and I used to have to take this home to my mother, and she gave me back a shilling. That was for my bus fares to go to work. And so called spending money, I suppose, and she took the rest. And then I never had any money, and I thought, I'm getting fed up with this. And I started looking around for other jobs, and all menial jobs, because I'd got no qualifications or anything like that. So I got a job in a cake shop, where they paid 7 shillings and 6 pence a week. And we could have as many cakes as we liked, so I went to work there. And my father's sister was a cook, and she worked in a working men's club on the fish docks. Wasn't a licensed club or anything like that. They used to go in for coffees and their midday meal and things like that. And she said to me, would you like to come and work with me down on the fish docks? And that was just as a tea girl and washing up and all menial jobs. And I said yes, because I got 10 shillings a week there. I went down to work with my aunt. But I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a nurse. So I didn't know whether I would be brainy enough, obviously, because I didn't do awfully well at school. But there was so all these jobs that I've just told you were sort of filling in time until I was old enough to go nursing. And there was a maternity hospital in Grimsby that would take girls at 17 years old for a year before they could start their general training at 18. So I applied to this Nunsthorpe maternity home, and I went for an interview, and I was accepted as part of the next intake. And my birthday was on the 16th of April, and I started at this hospital on the 1st of April and was decked out in this uniform. Very pretty, you know, the dresses and the aprons and the caps, and I felt really quite something. And the very first day I was there, I was in the kitchen making what I'd been told to make, teas and coffees and things for the patients. And one of the midwives, a staff midwife, came to the door and said, nurse! And I just stood there carrying on doing what I was doing. And she bellowed again, nurse! I'm speaking to you! And there was no one else there, so I turned around. But I mean, nurse, 2 hours in uniform is a wonderful feeling. And she said to me, have you ever seen a baby born? And I said, no. She said, well, get yourself round to our labour ward. There's a woman about to be delivered. And I was thinking, my goodness me. I mean, I wasn't yet 17. So I found my way round to this labour ward. And I stood there inside the door with this woman in agony on the... And I stood like this, just inside the door, watching this woman. And this midwife came in and she said, and don't you stand there with your arms folded. She said, get round to either side of that bed, she said, and hold that woman's leg up. So all 16 years of me, you know, and watching this baby appear. Fantastic. Oh, you really have to see these things to understand the effect it has on you. And it was just brilliant. I couldn't believe that it was this baby. And so that was my first, experience of seeing a baby born. And I loved my time there. I really did. I loved being in uniform, I loved being called nurse, and the patients were always so grateful. And their dads used to come in and take your photograph with their baby, and then they'd give you photographs. So many happy memories of that. There were tragedies, of course. I don't know how interested you are in what I'm saying, but... one of the saddest things there was that there was a woman came in in full-term pregnancy, not married, living with a man, quite acceptable these days, but in those days. They hadn't married, and she hadn't, because she was ashamed, she hadn't seen a midwife or a doctor, nothing. And she'd gone to full-term pregnancy without seeing anyone. So she was brought into the hospital as an emergency. And I'll try to explain it simply, but the head comes down, you know, and then when it's far enough down, it's sort of wedged in the pelvis, ready for delivery of the baby. And this she'd got this far in the labour and the head was wedged in the pelvic because the baby was too big. And she couldn't push anymore or anything like that, and she was too far advanced to have a cesarean. And so they did something called a craniotomy, and they inserted this vicious instrument and crushed the baby's skull. So delivered a dead baby, and the most beautiful baby boy you ever saw, but with this smashed skull. And I'm still only 17 and witnessing this, you know, and it's something I couldn't believe, and I'm heartbroken about it. But of course the baby was dead. They thought she would develop an infection, so she was put on the isolation unit, and I went with her, and I nursed her in isolation. But she died, and I thought that was tragic. And the father of the baby had been in to see her once or twice, and then he went home and committed suicide. And this was part of my life, the things that I saw and affected me, you know, I thought it was just awful. So, you know, sort of three lives just thrown away because of the times we lived in. It was so shameful, and you didn't tell anybody about these things.
Could all that have been avoided?
Oh, yes, if she'd had medical, yes. If she'd gone as a pregnant woman would to her doctor and then have a follow-up with... Even in those days, there was care for, you know, keeping an eye on people. They didn't do the scans and things like that. But they would have been able to say how the baby was growing and how it was progressing. And if it had got, you know, they'd thought there was any danger, then, of course, they would have taken her in, either induced her for the baby to come a bit earlier, or she would have had a cesarean section... And she would have... I'm not saying that the tragedy that followed would have been prevented even if she'd had a normal delivery because of the shame of having a baby and not being married. My goodness, we've come a long way since then, haven't we? And then I went, did night duty, and I saw twins delivered by cesarean section. And the woman had an epidural, so I was able to stand at her head and talk to her all the time this was going on. And again, it's just sheer amazement. You know, you're talking to this lady, and here she is being cut, and these babies pulled out of my mouth. And then another time, when I was on night duty, the midwife came round to me, and she said, "Have you ever seen her?" "No," she said. "I want you to go round to a labour ward. There's a dead baby, and I want you to lay it out, a stillborn baby." And I said, "I can't do that. I've never seen anyone dead." She said, "Well, if you're going to make this your profession, you've got to get in somewhere, and you might as well go, and I will come tell you exactly what to do and help you." And thought death, you know. And I went round to this labour ward, and there was this dear little baby laying there. And she said, "You have to get a bowl, you have to wash the baby, and then you have to make a gown for it." I don't suppose anything like that happens today, but in those days we did. And I had to get some lint, a roll of lint, and make a gown for this baby after I'd washed it, with a little frill at the neck and little frills at the sleeves. And then gamgee is cotton wool with a cotton gauze either side of it. And I had to make a bonnet out of gamgee. She showed me how to do it. I was crying all the time, needless to say. So I made this little gamgee bonnet as well and tied the bandage under the knee a little bow. I was absolutely, I was heartbroken. And then she said, she was kind, but she knew it had to be done and she knew that I had to learn how to do it. And then when I'd finished this, she said, "Now go to the ward," she said, "and find a very nice flower from one of the patient's vases and bring it back." So I did that. I had to cross this baby's hands across its chest like this and put this little flower in. Those are vivid memories, you know, because that was my introduction to death. I'd never seen anyone dead before. And I often wonder if it has a bearing on the way you deal with death after this. Because I nursed all my life, with breaks, obviously, and I never, ever had a death that I didn't go somewhere after I'd done everything I had to do, go somewhere and cry it out. Used to be heartbroken. So I didn't really come to terms with death very well, and I still don't. I hate people to die. Silly, isn't it? So I learned ever such a lot there. Also a nurse, we used to have what they call a sluice, where we did all the bedpans and the trays for dressings and things like that. And we used to use something called we used to call them perchloride pips. And they were like little blue tablets, like as big as an aspirin. And we used to dissolve those and sluice the women down with them. Very antiquated when you think now. But these were perchloride pips that we used to pour down the women and make sure there was no disease. And we had a nurse there, the same age as me, who one day took an overdose of these perchloride pips, and they were deadly, you know, and she died in the sluice. So that was another... It's only experiences, but I don't think it would happen today. Do you know, I don't know whether it would, but I think it was... Everything was so basic and... Oh. So I stayed my year at Nunthorpe at the Maternity Hospital, and then I went on to do my general training at the Grimsby and District Hospital.
What's all the time during that first year learning on the job?
Yes. You didn't get a certificate or anything like that for... I mean, it wasn't any training, it was experience, and it was, you know, extra hands for the nurses, because we did all the menial jobs, you know, all the baths and the looked after the babies and all that sort of thing. I just absolutely loved it. We used to bath the babies every morning, you know, so that gave you lots of experience for later, you know, with these tiny and prem babies and things like that. It was all wonderful experience. And you didn't go into the general training with no knowledge at all. You see, you knew how to wear a uniform, you knew how to behave, how to treat patients, so it was a good grounding. But then again, in those days, they didn't train nurses like they do today. They train in colleges. They do this there's a man called Salmon that invented this training in colleges with occasional visits to a ward. That man should have been shot, because it was absolutely wicked. The only way, I think, that a nurse can be trained is by contact with patients. You can't learn in school how to handle people. I don't think so. But that's just an observation. We went straight onto the wards. There was no medical school, no nothing. And we went straight onto the wards, and we learned that way, our training. We'd have young doctors, and they were learning as well, young junior doctors. And so we all sort of learned together, and then these young junior doctors, we used to have lectures every week, sometimes twice a week. And even if you were on night duty, you had to get up and attend these lectures. You couldn't miss a lecture. And then there were some from the consultants, obviously, the senior people. And then for sort of what they considered minor experience, they would let these junior doctors have a go, because they'd got to learn how to teach as well. And so I remember one day when we were all there, and there were about 24 or 5 of us, you see, in one group. And this poor young houseman came to give us a lecture on... what was the lecture called? It was about sex, anyway. Now, this poor wretched man... You know, no older than we were, trying to talk to a group of 24 girls about sex. I mean, can you imagine? He didn't know where to put himself or what to do, and we were sitting there. It was another memory that doesn't go away. I felt so sorry for him. So that's how we learned nursing. And my first job, I got a different uniform, of course, and lovely. And I was put on a men's medical ward. And I mean, nursed ladies and their babies for a year. It was a bit of a blow. And we had long wards of about 50 beds, 25 on each side. And these were all men with medical problems. And there was an Irish nurse called Cox, and she was a year senior to me, so she was showing me the ropes. And the first thing we did, when we went on duty, we had to report to the sister and have a report on each patient, what was wrong with him and what was treatments and things like that.